from KQED.
From KQED Cub Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Well, even the best of us may have committed an indiscretion or two in our lives, and perhaps maybe something even more than an indiscretion, maybe even a felony. Perhaps you've driven home drunk, or maybe you sold marijuana to your high school classmates or stole something like a pair of sneakers, but you were never caught. Well, how did your life turn out differently than someone who was caught and now has a record? That's the basis of Emily Baxter's project, We Are All Criminals. The former public defender interviewed 250 people nationwide about their crimes, crimes they got away with, and she joins us in studio today to talk about what she found. And she's director of the We Are All Criminals Project and a fellow at the University of Minnesota Law School's Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice. I'd like to have you explain the project, but first, before you do, let's hear from a couple of people, both anonymous. They told you about the crimes they committed and how their lives later turned out.
So when I was in college, I had to get knee surgery, and I thought this would be a good opportunity to make money elsewhere. And one of my buddies from high school, and it had become sort of the local drug kingpin, and so he fronted me a couple ounces of marijuana that I then just got surgery and sat on my couch and sold eighths of marijuana while I recuperated. So could definitely have been arrested. Yeah, fortunately I wasn't, and I finished college and went to graduate school, and now I'm a professor.
When I was 15, my mother died. But what I found myself doing was leaving school and going over to the shopping mall that was across the street and trying on clothes and stealing them. And fortunately, I was never caught. I'm happily married. I have two brilliant kids and work as a neighborhood activist.
Well, there you get a couple of samples of the interviews that our guest Emily Baxter did. And how did this all started with you being a public defender?
That's right. Several years ago, I was a public defender on the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. I left that practice for a number of reasons, but not the least of which was I felt like even when I was able to secure a favorable disposition for my client, that more often than not, they would find themselves locked out of countless life opportunities because of that interaction with the criminal justice system, that criminal record.
That felony on the record or on the jacket often meant housing problems, job problems, driver's license. I mean, just the whole gamut, right?
Education, voting, yes. The ability to cross the Canadian border.
To visit, say, a sick uncle, I think is the example you use, or any for any reason. So you felt this was unjust, particularly in light of the fact that maybe you were talking to prosecutors and police who were talking about driving intoxicated and not getting cited and not having any transgression on their record?
Sure, absolutely. I saw that the hypocrisy on a daily basis, but then also carried a lot of that hypocrisy with me. It wasn't revealed to me during that practice that people committed crimes and didn't get caught, but it was something that I was patently aware of when representing individuals who were caught for very similar activity.
So are we talking about the need for more second chances? Are we talking about the need for more reform or the need for maybe more arrests to make it an equal playing field?
I don't think I'm calling for more arrests necessarily. What I think is that our system is irrational and unjust and inequitable. I think that we certainly do need more second chances, but honestly, I think we need more first chances too. The answer isn't necessarily in more expungements or just hiring individuals with criminal records. I think we need to peel that back and look at our criminal code, look at the school-to-prison pipeline, look at how concentrated policing in minority communities is really devastating those communities.
Well, we passed Proposition 47 here in California, which made what were once felonies, many of them into misdemeanors, and that would seem to me to be, we just did a program on it recently, which is in our archives, that would seem to me to be a reasonable step forward in this. But of the 250 people you interviewed, majority of them were white, right?
That's right. The majority are white. I'm still actively interviewing people in case you're interested in revealing any of your past crimes after we're no longer on air. But yeah, the majority were white. And
well, not when you say that. No, and I'm not going to be defensive about that in any matter at all. But when you say the title is very engaging, We Are All Criminals, basically, is what that is. We Are All Criminals is the name of the project. And you're talking to people who were criminals, but of course were never prosecuted. But for some reason, that title, We Are All Criminals, I mean, there are people who never even did a scofflaw thing in their lives. You know, it almost suggests that everybody's culpable of not getting prosecuted at one time in their life.
Well, I do believe that's true. And the project title is intense. It's intentionally
hyperbolic.
I wouldn't say hyperbolic. I think that I appreciate that you have a visceral reaction. I appreciate that you don't like the title of the project because it's that sting of being called a criminal that for many people who were caught don't identify themselves as such. And I do believe that anybody who has existed in the society for any appreciable amount of time has violated the law. For example, in Minnesota, where I'm licensed, in the mid-1960s, our criminal code was no more than 32 pages long. Now, in 2015, it's well over 232 pages, and that's just one chapter in a much larger book. So every legislative session, we are criminalizing more and more activity, and each of those statutes and codes is broader and broader.
But when you're talking about criminalizing, you're talking mainly about felonies.
Not necessarily.
So anybody who jaywalked is a criminal?
Okay. So when I'm talking about how one in four of us, or according to the Bureau of Justice statistics, closer to one in three of us has a criminal record, I'm not talking about jaywalking. I'm talking about convictions.
There are people who have never done anything against the law. And a lot of them are listening to this program right now and thinking, how can you say we are all criminals? I don't want to get beyond the semantics here because there's some important stories in this, but I did find myself actually recoiling a bit at this title. Let's get to some stories here. You had actually a woman who was an alcoholic and later became a victim, and this is a pretty dramatic story. As I understand it, she was a victim in a drunk driving case.
Well, prior to that, she
had been driving drunk.
That's right. Yeah. She had been self-medicating as a 20-something. She was in a very bad relationship, and she found herself escaping her skin in the only way she could by drinking till blackout. And then she would drive home. She had 1,000 excuses as to why that was okay, but even knowing the risks, she still took those chances. Years went by. She got out of the relationship. She married a gentleman that she met in law enforcement training. And they had a deal that anytime they would go out, one would drink and the other would drive, but never would the two combine. So they had gone to a law enforcement benefit. They were driving home on a two-lane highway. They lived outside of town. And going 65 miles per hour when a drunk driver crossed into their lane and hit them head-on at 65. She said it was this explosion of engine and airbag and bones. She said that her husband had a 50% chance of survival. He was airlifted out and even now, years later, is so crippled in pain that he can't work. She herself had her career hopes dashed when her invite to be a part of the Secret Service was taken back after her injuries. So she said that for years after this, the drunk driver was essentially walked away. He wasn't injured. And she said that for years following this, she was just so overcome with anger that this man had taken so much from her and her husband. And it was crippling for her. She said that she could hardly eat or sleep. And it was affecting the way that she was viewing individuals at work as well, obviously.
And also affecting her view of crime and punishment, to put it mildly. Yeah.
And then one day she realized that could have just as easily been her behind the other wheel, that she could have destroyed somebody else's life, that she had taken that chance so many times. And while she said that she hasn't yet forgiven that man, she now finds that she's on the path to doing so. And it's that means that she is also more compassionate and filled with, I think, a greater humanitarianism in her work as a law enforcement agent.
On the other hand, didn't you find out someone in Minnesota who kicked people out of public housing but had done some rather things in his past that were transgressive?
Public housing is definitely an issue. You know, even though the federal government is waxing poetic about the need for safe and affordable housing for individuals with criminal records, local public housing authorities routinely block people from accessing that. I mean, there are some jurisdictions that prohibit individuals not just with, say, manufacturing methamphetamines on public housing grounds. That's actually a federal prohibition, and that one makes sense. There's a nexus there. But in some jurisdictions, you're prohibited from staying in public housing if you have a public disorder or a public intoxication or a public urination, which to me is preposterous because if you don't have your own bathroom, if you're sleeping under a bridge or in a park and you relieve yourself, something that, you know, I myself have done several times today, and my guess is that many of our readers have as well, that... It doesn't make sense to me that...
Please don't hear, by the way. No necessity.
Not public urination. I've been urinating in approved places.
This is a little bit TMI, maybe. getting into here. But actually, your role in interviewing these people, it's kind of a combination priestly therapist role, it strikes me. But you found that a lot of these people, in talking about the things that they had done, were tethered to feelings of guilt and maybe in some instances just even re-experiencing what they had done in ways that made them palpable.
Well, that's fascinating, Michael. At first, I didn't offer any kind of absolution, right? At first, I treated it in a very clinical manner. An individual would come in, we would shake hands, they'd sign a waiver, I'd turn on a recorder and say, "Tell me what you've done." After the confession, if you will, then they would leave. I would type it up and post it. What I found happening was that in the weeks after that posting, I would get phone calls from individuals who had participated saying that they hadn't gotten out of bed in a few days, that they had been overwhelmed with the sense of shame and depression. They felt like they were psychologically tethered to that place that they were in when they committed that crime. And I hadn't realized that what I was doing to those participants was very similar to what a criminal record was doing to my clients. And so now in the years since that mistake, I have worked to just rehabilitate the individuals who are participating in the project by asking them how life is now and talking to them about how they prefer to define themselves rather than by their past mistakes.
Well, let me invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation. I don't know if we can go into a confessional mode here, but I'm sure there are some narratives that may be evoked by this conversation we're having with Emily Baxter, and you may have questions about the project. It's called the We Are All Criminals Project. She directs it. She's also a fellow at the University of Minnesota Law School's Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice, and she'll also be speaking at Google tomorrow at noon, and the talk is free and open to the public. It's on the Google campus on Charleston Road. Invite your participation. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, 866-733-6786, and also welcome your emails, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Looking at a couple of listener responses right here that sort of may represent the ends of the continuum. First listener, Denise, writes, 99% of my students are criminals. We have selective memories. Dig deep into your past because any law broken over the age of 14 is subject to be punished in adult court. In the age of hyper-incarceration, this is an important project to challenge the narratives of difference between society's manufactured criminals and ourselves. We think we are so different from them. Get honest. What we mean is better than. What do you have the luxury of forgetting? So here's another listener, however, who writes, I have never driven home drunk. I have never stolen anything from anyone. I have never sold drugs to anyone, period. No one is perfect, but the law is the bottom line. It's a line that most people never cross. I believe that that listener is talking about maybe felonies or far more serious transgressions. But you may want to add your voice. In fact, let's hear from our first caller joining us from Chicago. Bill, you're on the air.
Michael, great show. I want to take an equally hyperbolic point of view. A first-time date rapist, he probably was just raised in a misogynistic household or might have just thought that behavior's okay. So does he rate a second chance? Should he not be considered a criminal? Or a hate crime person? You know, they were raised in a household where that kind of ignorance, just caused them to act in inappropriate ways. Do they get a second chance? And I'm just kind of curious from the guest point of view, where do we draw the line? If we start making distinctions about everyone's a criminal, then you wind up downplaying a lot of crimes. And I'm pretty sure she wouldn't lionize individuals who committed date rape, never got caught and got away with it, or other violent or nonviolent crimes, sexual or otherwise. If a group of, if an individual, beat up a homosexual, I'm pretty sure that's not something that someone should go around being proud of, going, well, that's not really a crime. And thank you for a very challenging and interesting discussion. I'll take that comment off.
All right, Bill, thank you for your comments. And let's go to Emily Baxter on them. Emily?
Sure, absolutely. I'm not saying by any means that there shouldn't be consequences to harm, and by no means am I saying that there isn't harm committed. People are victimized across the United States every day. And
you're not necessarily saying that people should be identified with, well, for example, hardcore criminals. When you say we are all criminals, what comes to mind are some of the things he mentioned, which are pretty serious crimes.
What I am saying is that there is real harm that is done. And I'm saying that when we conduct, when we construct responses or consequences to that harm, they must be reasonable. They must be rational. They must be equitable. They must be merciful. And in my opinion, there must be an end to that punishment, because without hope, what does one have?
We'll bring more callers on and find out what our listeners have to say. We go next to you, Ron. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. I want to go back to the exchange you had with your guest about the semantics of the title. And I just want to support her. And I think it's an important part beyond semantics, because I think it's provocative. It's not overly verbose or exaggeratory. I think that it's an important point. I mean, I'm 64 years old, and I don't think I've ever met the nicest old lady in the world you can imagine hasn't done something. And I'd be surprised if somewhere in this discussion it wouldn't come up about the white-collar criminals who the penalties that they get don't really hurt them at all, because, they can afford their own house.
Well, we're all human. We all make mistakes, and we all have flaws, and we all have things perhaps that we're ashamed of and all that. I guess I was just reacting to the we are all criminals, the use of the word criminals. You find that okay, though, Barn, huh?
I find it provocative. That's all. And I think the point is well taken. Like I said, I think we've all done something and haven't gotten caught.
Okay.
That's
thanks,
why
Ron.
It's so hard to pass a lie detector test, by the way.
Yeah, well, they're not necessarily by any means absolutely reliable. Thanks, Ron, for the call. Let me get another caller on. It's Toby. Welcome. You're on.
Hi.
Hi.
When I was 18 years old, I was caught trying to steal a cube of butter and a package of M&Ms from Safeway in Denver. And they came and got me, the police came and got me and threw me in jail for that. And I'm currently a preschool teacher, and I've had a lot of issues with this. I mean, it's just the most ridiculous thing. I'm sure that it's cost the city of Denver like hundreds of dollars to have me in jail and prosecute me. And I actually lost a preschool job because of it. I was called into the office and told, oh, we can't have you here anymore. And I get home, and I have a letter from the State of California Social Services that says, we are writing to inform you that you have a criminal record. And it just...
For stealing candy.
For trying to steal candy.
Trying to steal candy.
It haunted me to this day. And I just wanted to put that out there and see what you're...
No, I'm glad you did. I think, Emily Baxter, this is where you obviously get concerned about the laws and how they're enforced and the records that accrue.
Sure, it's one of the places. Yeah, after leaving public defense, I worked in policy for about half a decade. And while I was seeking to educate everyone from employers to landlords to legislators and licensing boards about the need to create the capacity for second chances, I was also representing individuals who were seeking expungements. And I heard time and again stories very similar to your caller's. Someone who had done something, perhaps serious, perhaps truly petty, years or even decades ago, and were still haunted by that past mistake.
Well, let me thank you for the call. That's Toby. And here's a listener who writes, before I turned 21, I'd smuggled wholesale quantities of drugs across international borders and operated a multi-employee drug delivery service. Had I been caught smuggling in the country I smuggled to, I might still be in prison. I'm 42. How many of your guest interviewees would not be criminals if our ridiculous drug war did not exist?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the greatest mistakes has been our war on drugs, and certainly the way in which that has played out. I have countless stories from participants about both the use and the sale of controlled substances, and now they are doctors and lawyers and legislators and police officers and business leaders and faith leaders. And yet, had they been caught, I really have to wonder where they would be now.
Our guest is Emily Baxter, and again, she directs the We Are All Criminals Project, and she'll be speaking at Google tomorrow at noon. Talk is free and open to the public on the Google campus on Charleston Road. Go to another caller, and that's you, Liam. Good morning.
Hey, how you doing today?
Okay, thanks.
Just calling in, you know, Emily, I love the topic. It's great. And, I'm in full support. I think obviously there are some crimes that when committed definitely deserve to be punished. But, you know, you named a few that I think you'd be hard pressed to find a lot of people who haven't committed. I myself have, you know, done multiple of those, a lot of those things you said. And I'm currently in a good job and I have the ability to benefit and better myself. And if I had been caught for some of these petty crimes that, you know, now I wouldn't do, but in my youth it committed, I wouldn't be in a position to better myself. I wouldn't be in a position to better my family and provide. But alas, you know, I'm here and I'm doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your call, Liam. And it sort of brings out also another important fact, I think, that probably has come out of this project of yours, Emily, and that is people do a lot of things in their youth that they're sorry for, that haunt them, and they become often, you know, good citizens, good people. I mean, certainly law-abiding people. So there's that chasm between something that you can't put behind you. It's like these kids who put pictures on Facebook now or something from their revelries and their wild, drunken whatever, and then, you know, have to worry about them getting employment or getting an interview.
That's
for employment.
Age.
Here's another listener who writes, expunging is great. I committed a number of serious felonies as a teenager. Had things gone the other way, I would have been in prison for years and not been a contributing member of society. Thanks to a justice system that was willing to be flexible, I have lived a full life. Having these charges expunged from my record saved my life. Another listener writes, we often hear that ignorance of the law is no excuse. However, we increasingly have laws that few, if any of us, know about. I claim that laws that the average person doesn't understand are inherently unjust and undermine the moral legitimacy of the legal system. And we go to more of your calls. Let me bring a caller on from San Rafael. James, welcome. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I would characterize the United States as a country that won't be happy until one half has the other half under lock and key. And I think until we address this underlying pathology of punishment in this country, we're going to have terrible trouble from now on.
Well, the incarceration rates among African Americans are particularly dramatically and extraordinarily high. And one has to ask, as many do, about the system and how it's bent that way or, you know, bent toward incarcerating people because of the color of their skin. They can get a mark on their record like anybody else and then suddenly face the same kind of impediments and obstacles that you've been talking about here, like jobs, housing, voting, not being able to vote, and so forth. Let me get another caller on here, and that's Jonas. Morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to provide some couple of reflections as a social scientist on the subject. I think the subject is very provocative, and I think what the title should be, We Are All Imperfect. And I got to reflect on, because I lived overseas, and I got to see how other communities deal with young kids, for example, teenagers, when they misbehave, when, might that be when they steal or when they use drugs. And it's such, there's such a community effort to resolving these issues, and it never gets to the criminal justice system. And it usually resolves itself. And we don't have that in our culture here in the United States. It's such a culture that is devoid of compassion. Yeah. And it is so inundated with the fear of the other, and that's why we have such a big gun problem. In a sense, the Puritan values that have created this country are still the same values that govern them in terms of criminal justice. And I think that is one factor that we need to think about from a policy perspective.
Well, we thank you for that and appreciate Jonas and Emily Baxter. Comment from you?
I agree with Eunice.
Agree with the caller?
I do. I do want to go back to one thing that you said about African Americans and the kind of everlasting punishment of a criminal record and how that's similar to anybody else that may carry that same.
I was thinking about Michelle Alexander's work. Are you familiar with it?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Yes, she's incredible. I was actually thinking about Diva Pager, though, another professor, another doctor. And Diva Pager some years ago, she's a sociologist, and she examined the effect of a criminal record on entry-level job seekers. She had a black man and a white man, two groups of people, white men and black men, both with very similar resumes, and half of which had a fictitious criminal record. I think it was 18 months in prison, if I recall correctly, for possession with intent to sell. And she then tracked the callback rates for these individuals and their attempts to find jobs. And she found that for the white men without criminal records, their rates of callback for job interviews, I think it was 34%. For white men without criminal records, it was 17%. For black men for white men without criminal records,
you reversed
34.
Them, yeah.
Yeah. White men with criminal records, 17%.
Right.
Yeah. For black men without criminal records, the callback rates were 14%. So 3% lower than the white men who had criminal records, who were already profoundly impacted by the presence of that record. And then for black men who did have a criminal record, their rates of callback was just 5%. And this was before our economic crash.
I wish we had more time. In fact, apologies to listeners who we didn't get on the air here. Next caller wanted to know about your thoughts on restorative justice and second chances. You're in favor. I think
absolutely.
It's safe to say. Thank you, Emily Baxter. Good to have you with us. The project, again, is called We Are All Criminals, and she's a fellow at the University of Minnesota Law School's Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice, and you can see her at Google tomorrow at noon. The talk is free and open to the public at the Google campus on Charleston Road. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, and our senior editor, Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.